Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life. Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects, even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing. Welcome, everybody, to the podcast today. Where is the applause? Wake up, people. Wake up. They were scared. We had David Dasmalchian on last week, and the studio audience is still a little shaken up. A little shaken up from that experience. That was such a great episode. If you haven't listened to it, be sure to listen to it. Also, I need to just say as a reminder right off the top, if you like the podcast and you want to tell us about it, please leave us a voicemail. It's at speakpipe.com/lifewritingpodcast. That's speakpipe.com/lifewritingpodcast. We love playing your messages on the air. We have a great guest today, a newer author, which is fun because we talk to so many more established writers. It's really nice to have a newer author on the show. Brent Lambert is his name. But before we get to Brent, you know, if you listen, you know what to do about this time. Let's talk about what's going on. Get your praise on. Okay, so what is going on? Steve, as I mentioned, or if I haven't mentioned it, I will now, is the last push now, I think, for his Mace Windu novel, The Glass Abyss. So that's why you've only heard my voice so far. He's not here, up to his ears in the deadline. And of course, as they say, when it rains, it pours. Because for the past couple weeks now, and through a couple weekends now, I think this is our third or fourth weekend, we're working straight through on a surprise script assignment. That's all I'm going to say about it. It's been a real joy and learning experience to be in the trenches on a moving train, like something that's already in progress, and you're just brought on to help out as opposed to trying to roll that mountain up the hill all by yourself. So that has been a very eye-opening experience, the difference between those two realms when it comes to Hollywood and movies. And, you know, we never know the outcome of any of this stuff. Everything is a learning experience. That's first and foremost where I plant my attitude about these assignments. Is like, okay, this is a great opportunity to learn, a great opportunity to do something new. It's really fun, you know, a little stressful sometimes when, you know, it's a little stressful, but also really fun. And in the rare down moments, I'm really proud of the fact that I'm continuing to work on my major work in progress, which is Bear Creek Lodge, the novel I'm writing, based out of my short stories, Incident at Bear Creek Lodge and Return to Bear Creek Lodge. And I'm having fun. You know, that's sort of the gift I give to my inner child, is to work on that passion project. Even though it's already sold, it still feels like a passion project, the thing I would do, even if nobody was lined up to buy it. And I'm especially happy that the scenes I'm writing take place when my protagonist is a very young child, because I love, you know me, I love child protagonists. My last novel, The Reformatory, had dual child protagonists. This one, we're only going to see her in childhood for a little while, and then the next youngest protagonist is probably going to be about 13, 14, and the rest will be all adults. But just being inside a seven-year-old's mind is really helping me remember what it was like to be seven, the kinds of things that excited me, the kinds of things that upset me, sort of this unrealistic image my character has of herself. But at the same time, she's going to live up to that unrealistic image, because she just has endless audacity. And I knew her as an older character already from my short stories, but this is my first time meeting her as a child. And it's going to be very interesting following her on that journey from this child she began as to that older woman some of the readers already know. So I'm having a great time working on that. But honestly, you know what? Enough of me. We have a guest. So it's only polite not to leave the guest in the green room, even though we did bring in papaya this time and pineapple. And guava. So hopefully he's enjoying that. Brett Lambert is a Black queer man who heavily believes in the transformative power of speculative fiction across media formats. He resides in San Diego, but spent a lot of time moving around as a military brat. His family roots are in the Cajun country of Louisiana. Currently, he manages the social media for Faya Literary Magazine, which is a great literary magazine, and just had an anthology produced with Tor.com titled Breathe Faya. And of course, he has a novella that came out last fall called Unnecessary Chaos that got a great review in Locus and really, frankly, helped land him on this show. So now you know he's hit the big time. Welcome, everybody, Brent Lambert. Come on in. All right. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me. I'm super stoked to be here. This is awesome.
I'm very excited to have you here, too. And I love that great smile on your face. So that means so far everything's going well.
Yeah.
You know, I thought I would do something that I do rarely for guests. You know, I had one guest come on and read an excerpt from my work, which was that was different. But in the past, I have read an excerpt from a poet's work. So I just thought it might be fun to start the podcast by me reading from your novella, Unnecessary Chaos, a reading by Tanana Rivtu. Precise judgment was a prerequisite for Vade's work, and he could say without a doubt that nobody had an ass like Althus. Vade watched his assignment, his lover, his something he didn't have the courage to name yet, walk towards the pristine ocean completely naked. Their bodies were the most honest thing between them. Hey, what do you think of that crowd? What about that? Come on now. If that's how it starts, how do you put it down from there? That's all I have to say. So I just wanted to do that because it really, when I started reading your book, it's like, oh, okay. We're right to it. This is great. And, you know, this is a genre-defying work. As the Locus Review pointed out, it's science fantasy on the one hand. It has a little bit of supernatural horror elements. Would you also consider it as something what I would call a romanticy?
So, you know what? It's funny. Someone else also asked me that. And my immediate response was I didn't come into that with the intention of it. But I also kind of feel like the way I kind of feel as an author is like, there's the way I receive it, and then there's the way readers receive it. And like both are like very valid. So I feel like if readers are receiving it in that kind of romanticy vein, then who am I to question it? Like, you know, it's like I don't necessarily want to intrude on how readers receive it. So I have had quite a few of them slotted into that. And then it's caused me to kind of like step back and think about it. And it's like, you know what? Maybe it does fit into this conversation of romanticy.
Well, I think it could be in part just because it starts so strongly focused on the relationship and the attraction between these two characters. It's hard to think of it otherwise. And of course, it's very bold and it's very queer. And it's like, this is what this is. You know what this is from page one. So don't tell me you didn't know what this is. And I wanted to ask you about your journey with speculation and speculative art, because your bio talks about the impact that you think it can have. And I absolutely agree with you that it does have a great impact. I really think all marginalized groups, I mean, really everyone, but in particular, marginalized groups find different aspects of speculation that appeal to them based on their experiences in the world, which is how all of us approach, you know, what we read. So according to your race, your gender, your sexual orientation, your ethnicity, how would you characterize what drew you to speculative work? And how do you believe that attraction was impacted by race and queerness?
So for me, I think what initially drew me to speculative work was just being a kid who constantly moved around all the time from one state to sometimes even different countries. I had no sense of permanence. And so when I found speculative fiction, I found if I couldn't control my world, at least I could control my imagination. And, you know, so I think one of the first big works that kind of like drew me in was comic books, actually. So the X-Men, I found the X-Men. My dad gave me my first X-Men comic. And I was like, oh, these people are different. And they all congregate together and they get to be different as a whole. And, you know, so it kind of gave me, as I was discovering myself as like, you know, a queer kid, I kind of saw like, maybe there is hope for me. And then, you know, I found the Chronicles of Narnia and it was like, it kind of scratched that itch of, I just wish I could disappear sometimes because, you know, being a Black gay kid, trying to figure that out and be okay with it.
And a military brat.
And a military brat.
So you're living on military bases, right?
Right. Yeah. And just having like that sort of like, especially in my childhood, like the Army very much had some of those toxic masculine traits going on. And it was just like, it's a culture. And, you know, and I was like, I don't fit in. And so, you know, I kind of wanted to disappear. And then, you know, I found the Animorph series. Like it just kind of kept going. Each one fed into me differently. And these kids could transform. And I was like, I just want to transform. I just want to be something else. And so at some point, you know, like, I was starting to create my own worlds and like wanting to tell stories too. And I had a very cool middle school teacher who told me, she was like, I think you could do this one day. You should actually write these, keep going, keep using this imagination. And there was a point I almost gave up and it was more so because of Blackness at this point. Cause I got to a point when I was reading fantasy, I'm like, where are we at? I you know,
I know that's right.
Like, where are we at? Why are we not here? And then I had a coworker who gave me David Anthony Durham's Acacia series. And I read that and I was like, oh, I'm not giving up now. Like, I'm not quitting until I can do something that makes me feel the way that this book series made me feel. And I kind of understood too that like there's a duty, I think, for marginalized writers to keep going and not give up, because we don't know the readers that need us, you know. So for me, at least at that point, I think it kind of became a purpose. You know, I was like, I want to make sure that I can help keep someone else like me from not feeling like they can find themselves in these stories. So
let me ask you this. I'm just wondering, you know, as a kid growing up, I would imagine that there were a lot of times you felt like you were keeping a secret. I mean, you didn't need to go like too deep in your business and your family, but I'm just wondering if that idea of hiding queerness, for example, because you can't hide the race part.
Yeah, exactly. No.
if we could, there would not be much of a black population in some situations. Like black people would never get pulled over by police. Black, you know.
I'll flip that switch as soon as the cop rolls by, like, whoop.
But did that notion of hiding impact the way you approached your writing as a younger person?
Yes, it did. And I didn't hide successfully. I thought I was hiding successfully. You know, it was like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to write Black characters. So I'm like, you know, I was you know, very much like, I want to do that. And I think I poured into that, hoping that somehow the queerness wouldn't be seen. And I think it was very early on, I wrote this terrible fantasy novel, but a coworker was gracious enough to read it, and he knew I was gay. And so he kind of came up to me afterwards. He was like, did you intend to, do people know now? And I was like, what do you mean? He was like, oh, Brent. And so he goes through it, and he's like,
you told on yourself, honey.
Yeah, he was like, you told on yourself. And so I kind of realized that was kind of a pivotal experience for me, because I was like, even if I try, I can't hide it. So I might as well not try and just, you know, stop hiding. So yeah, I think trying to hide it probably stunted my growth as a writer in the beginning.
Ooh, and, say that.
Yeah,
People who've listened to this podcast have heard me tell this story before, but I wasn't intentionally trying to hide race. It didn't even dawn on me to try to hide race, because the canon I was exposed to in college and graduate school did not include me. Like you're talking about, a lot of fantasy you had come in contact with, it did not include race. It did not include Blackness. So because so many of the stories I read were like that, my notion of what a story was a white man having an epiphany in a quiet way. So there was no genre. It was like, and then I wondered, why can't I sell my stories? Why? Because you were not writing from any kind of authentic part of yourself, darling. I mean, yeah, we're all human, and we can all sort of guess what a white man's human experience would be, but why not let the white male writers do that about their own experiences and write ourselves, which is such a revelation. So when did you first decide to just like be right out there in terms of the queerness in your fiction?
You know, I think I had to first be out there in my personal life. So, you know, I think once I came out to my parents and friends, at that point, I was like, well, I don't have anything else left to lose. Like, so, and also the way that most of them were so accepting of it, kind of like, I kind of felt like, I was like, why didn't I just do this earlier? So, once I came out to all of them, at that point, I kind of like went full steam ahead with it. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about publication so much at that point in my life. I was just writing to write. The idea of kind of like being published was, you know, always back there, but I didn't even know where to begin or how to start. So I was just creating to create. And
was it short stories or novels? What were you writing?
Novels. I was terrible ones that will never see the light of day. But
how many did you say you burned through before you got to your first publication?
Ooh, I'd say maybe like 5 or 6. Yeah. I would say 7, but one was like halfway, and I just realized, I'm like, yeah, that's not going to work. Oh. So, yeah. But yeah, I burned through a few. I was definitely, I got the million words out the way really quick. And then, you know, I kind of realized once I moved out here to California and kind of like started being alone, because I moved out here, I didn't know anyone, and just kind of like being alone and trying to build a life, I kind of like started realizing that, okay, I do want to do this. I do want to make a career out of this. I want to get published one day. And then, you know, I kind of like started doing that research, making those connections, meeting people, and then just learning the industry. So it was a bit of a journey, but.
What would you say was like your kick in the stomach? Like you thought you were going to have something or do something and it just didn't work out? Or did you have one of those that stands out?
I did have one.
So, tell us all about it. Yeah. The bad old days.
So it was when Div Pit used to be a pretty big thing on Twitter, say maybe 6 or 7 years ago. So I...
What is it?
I had Div Pit. It was like a diversity pitch. So they would pitch their idea in the tweet. Yeah. So I pitched my novel that I, you know, thought was good and finished at the time. And it got like so many retweets, so many likes. I had all these agents like wanting to look at it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So I was excited. I was like, oh, okay. I'm about to break in. This is happening. And I send it out there and nobody bites. Nobody bites. I get like not harsh feedback. Nobody was harsh at all. But, you know, it was definitely some feedback like, oh, I'm not so sure about this. Or like, oh, well, you know, this isn't that strong, you know, so on and so forth. So I learned a couple of things from that. One of the things I learned was like, okay, well, you can pitch an idea at least. Like, at least you can pitch it and get people's attention. But then I learned like, okay, this wasn't ready. This wasn't as strong as it needed to be. You need to keep grinding, get level up. Like, and you know, I also learned too, I can handle rejection. So I think I learned, I was like, okay, I'm kind of equipped for this, because I see some of my peers and they completely fall apart when the rejection comes. So it sucked, but I was able to push through it. So, you know, I there was definitely some good and lessons that came out of it.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
What would you say is the biggest thing that you learned as a writer that helped you break through to being a professional level writer?
Get over your feelings a little bit. Like, you gotta, like, it's this tightrope of professionally, you gotta be able to let stuff go. And then, but at the same time, when you're writing, you have to have all the heart and all the feelings. So you gotta learn to be a tightrope, and you gotta balance it out. And because
you mean also, in terms of listening to feedback?
Like understanding too that it's okay to let go of a project and move on to something else, or understanding that something may not be that time for it, and it's okay to like move on. Because I see some writers, they'll be working on the same manuscript for like 10 years and they get stuck in this rut where they can't move past it, and they can't, like, you know. And I'm like, if you want a career, You got to be able to move past things. And so, yeah, that was one of the biggest lessons I learned, is just don't take stuff to heart so much on the professional side.
That's great. That's exactly the armor you need to be able to succeed. So what was the big moment? Like, what led to your first publication? That had to be a great feeling. And what was it?
Yeah. So when after Fire won the Hugo Award, which was just such a big moment. And
I feel like, know, I might have met you. Were you in that room? Like there was a room where a bunch of people were sitting at the table and we were all talking.
I think we did. Yes, yes. Yeah. I think we did. I was just like my headspace. I was just like so starstruck. Okay. I was like all these cool people. And just,
yeah, I think we were Toastmasters, Steve and I, that year.
Was that the one in Chicago? Because I was at the one in
Chicago.
D.C. Oh, okay. I wasn't in Chicago. Okay. So I was at D.C. when we won. And I met, you know, quite a few people. And I got to, a couple of months before that, I had been, Dave Ring, who's actually the publisher for Neon Hemlock, he reached out to me and was like, hey, do you have any ideas for like a novella, possibly? And so I had pitched a few to him. I wasn't super sure like which one I wanted to go with. And he kind of was like, I like this one with the whole spy angle. And like, it feels like this would be really kind of angsty. And so see what you can do with it. I was like, okay. I hadn't written a single word of it. So I was starting it from scratch. And, you know, I gave him like an outline just to kind of like get his vibe on it. And he was like, oh, I really want to do this. Let's do it. And so at WorldCon, we had a chance to kind of like meet up, talk about it. He gave me some really good feedback. And yeah, I just left there feeling like really empowered. Like I can make this story actually work. I think it could happen. So
that was your first one.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had written some shorts before, but I had never I've had a couple of shorts published before then, but I had never written anything beyond like, I don't know, 5,000 words that had like been published. So this was like the first time. And the fact that like it happened without the thing actually being even finished, I was kind of like nervous. I'm like, I don't know. We'll see if I can.
That's great.
Make it happen. Yeah.
I mean, I find it really inspirational just to know someone's waiting for it. You know what I mean? Like it legitimizes the idea to you, because I went through this with a reformatory. I did decide to write it before trying to sell it. But my agent and I went through it and he knew the story. And I had an editor, Joe Monti at Saga Press, looking out for it because I tweeted about it all the time. So he knew it was coming and coming. It was years. But just knowing that someone was waiting on the other end, I don't know. Did you have a contract?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Oh,
did
so you sold it. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So it was sold and it was like.
You sold it on a pitch.
Yeah.
You didn't even have any pages written. You just sold it on a pitch.
Yeah, I had the idea and I gave him like a pretty brief outline and he was like, I'm with it. And he sold it on the pitch.
That is amazing. Do you know how rare that is? That is amazing. So good for you.
Thank you.
Not the usual way things go.
No, obviously, especially for someone who's new. Like I was like, there's no way. Like, yeah. So I definitely took that to heart for sure.
Well, it sounds like you have a very proactive editor and he absolutely knew what he was looking for. And he heard it when he saw it, when he heard it. He's like, that's it. That's it. That works for me. What do you think, what aspect, and I'd love to move towards sort of the world building part of your novel, because, well, first of all, give people the thumbnail pitch. What is it about?
So essentially it is about these two spies. One is like more of an anarchist. One works for sort of this corporatist government. And they've been assigned to spy on each other, and they've been doing so by pretending to be in this relationship, a la like Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And along the way, both of them are kind of wondering, do they actually have feelings for each other? And right as they're on this precipice, they both get the order, they got to kill each other. So it's kind of like, what do they do? Do they follow their ideals or do they follow their hearts? So.
Interesting. So, and it's set where? Is it future? Is it alternate, like a fantasy realm? Where is it set?
Yeah, so I'm definitely a secondary world guy. So I definitely consider this this is definitely a secondary world. It's not Earth for sure. If I could describe the world, it's kind of like Final Fantasy VII a little bit in terms of like how you have like people on motorcycles, but there's also people casting magic. There's also like people with, you know, there's cities with, you know, with refineries and all the tech that comes along with it. But it's right alongside monsters and demons and magic.
Yeah. You know, that your premise, there are a lot of writers I could see who would have a great premise like that. It's like, yeah, I want to tell this story and then kind of get hung up by the world building because they hadn't thought it through. It's not, you seem to have a gift for world building in terms of, like you said, the relationship between sort of tech and magic. That's something that you're holding in your head. And there's a lot of politics in this story. So tell me how sort of the real world had an impact on your world building.
Definitely. So in terms of like, one thing has always kind of like irritated me when I talk with Americans sometimes, particularly ones who aren't as like well-traveled or well-studied, they'll make these assumptions about countries like, say, like, I don't know, like Colombia or like Iran or like, you know, Nigeria. And they'll comment on like how they're so corrupt or backwards or, you know, all these things. They make all these negative assumptions. And I'm kind of like, I constantly have to check people. I'm like, well, do you know this is because of our interference in these countries? Right. Like, do you understand? Like, we are the cause of so much strife in the world. And so I really wanted to kind of like extrapolate this idea of like us destabilizing other countries and other cultures. And so that's kind of where the idea of one of the main characters, the one who works for the corporatist government, comes from, because that's what he kind of is. He's almost like one of those CIA agents that will go into a country or a movement, because even in our own country, we destabilize like social movements. And so,
yeah, actually, we're watching that happen on college campuses around the country right now, including UCLA, which
had
a horrible experience with infiltrators, basically.
Now,
outside of the, I mean, people say outside agitators, and that's usually like a dog whistle term back from the civil rights era, as if Black people wouldn't have sense enough to figure out that they want rights on their own. But in UCLA's case, there actually were people from the outside who were coming in to disrupt that encampment. So yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I wanted to play with that idea and like have a character who kind of is an extrapolation of that very real historical fact. So that was one of the key like tent poles of the world building. And so I built around that. And then I also wanted to kind of think about like magic and capitalism. I wanted to kind of like find a way to like get those two to talk to each other. And so that's why you have the dimensions that these people are literally mining like a gold mine that they think that they can pull this magic from and use it like as a resource.
That reminds me of a term that jumped out from this book that I think you made up, magicked, M-A-G-G-I-C-T.
Yes, yeah.
Which is a slur, basically, right? And tell people what it means.
So it's basically a combination of the word like magic and maggot. And so it's like, you know, insulting people that are kind of like trying to use magic as like as a weapon, as a resource, as something to exploit. And so there's a lot of people who view those people who use magic in that way and in a negative light. So that term is kind of like a slur against like it's definitely a slur that is meant to punch up and not punch down. So So I kind of wanted to, you know, because I think sometimes like people will, especially in fantasy, I've noticed they always create slurs that are meant to like punch down. And I was like, why do we never show that like people that are considered like less than or like in the lower classes, that they have their own agency and they're perfectly capable of critiquing people above them?
All right. I love it. What would you say to authors who struggle with world building in terms of like, are there sets of questions you ask yourself when you set out to create an alternate world story like this that are just sort of set? Like, okay, what's the commerce? What's the this? What's the that? Or does it come to you sort of story by story? What are your tools for good world building?
So it definitely varies project to project for me. But I think for me, at least essentially, is that I think the biggest rule I have is that don't be married to whatever you come up with. Be willing to let the world building change as you're writing the story to fit whatever you want it to, whether it's characters or themes or whatever. Because I think I see people get tripped up is that they think they have to have it all figured out before they write the story, or they think that what they come up with is like locked in stone and they have to follow it like a rubric as they go through the story. And that's not true at all. Like, be willing to, if you get to a point where something's just fun, you just want to throw it in there, throw it in there, and then you can figure out how it fits into the world afterward. Like, you know, and for me personally, I think the biggest question I always kind of ask and start off with, and it took another podcast to kind of like give me the tool to actually explain it. What am I presuming and what am I choosing?
Because when let's go into that. Yes.
Yeah. So like when you're creating a world, like let's like with my world, I'm presuming that they have the same kind of gravity as Earth, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if I was to choose a different kind of gravity, then I gotta like think about how that changes everything else in the world, right? So like with this one, I assume some basic things. Most people assume basic things like, okay, it's probably in a solar system similar to ours. It's probably a planet with similar gravity, similar weather patterns, whatever. And then what I started choosing was like, okay, but magic exists on this world. So I'm choosing magic to exist. Now, from there, am I deciding that, does everyone know about magic? Is it a common thing or is it something, you know, grand and mystical? So like, for instance, just as an example, I see sometimes people have mages of like great power in their world or whatever. Now, realistically, if someone could call down a tornado at will in the world, that person's probably going to be in charge. It doesn't make sense for someone like that to be living in squalor. Now, you know,
that's true.
So, good point. So if you're going to have them living, let's just say you want them to live in squalor, well, you need to be able to build the world around to justify that. Like justification is, I think, the core of presuming and choosing.
That is great advice. What you presume and what you choose. I love it because I can see how for a lot of writers, especially if you're writing fantasy, but also in science fiction, there are so many options. There's so many options for how a world can be, where a world can be, the kinds of creatures who inhabit that world, that you can really get stuck, you know, and your advice that you don't have to know it all. But just enough, I figure, you know, have enough information that you can put your character's feet on solid ground. And it's not every conversation is an info dump. How do you avoid info dump, which is, you know, that phenomenon where in a story, someone says, well, you know, on our planet, we have two moons. So blah, 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 blah. And they're speaking to somebody who's from the planet who already knows they have two moons. So, I mean, one way I get around that is to have an every person character who just doesn't know. Like, they don't know. So somebody has to explain things to them. But also, you can't do that too much. How do you handle info dump?
So, yeah. So I always, the way I've kind of explained this to people is think of your characters in terms of like a car, right? So if I get in my car, what I know about the car is I know I can turn the ignition on. I know I can press the brakes and the gas pedal. I know the trunk will pop open. That's what I know as just a regular car driver. Now, if your character is a mechanic, they're going to know that they can look in the hood, that they can, you know, tinker with the engine or whatever, and they can tell me, you know, about how the car works. So it would make sense if I'm talking to the mechanic for the mechanic to explain the car to me. It doesn't make sense if I'm talking to another car driver and we're talking about how the car works, right? So
no.
So the way I kind of approach it is like, what does it make sense for your character to know and to not know? So if my character is a swordsman, well, it makes sense for them to know about positioning your legs, feet, balance, and all that good stuff. So I think you have to be okay when you're creating these worlds with not explaining some stuff right away. Just have it on the page and the reader will trust the reader to stick with you through the ride. Because I saw another metaphor that was really cool too. And I think about it a lot in terms of like world building. When you're building a whole new world and you're telling a whole new story, you're basically asking readers to hike with you up a mountain. Now, if you're starting that hike and you're giving them a 60-pound book bag and you're telling them, let's go, most readers are like, nah, I'm putting this down. I'm not doing this with you. But if you give them something that maybe is like 5 pounds, you walk up a mile, you give them a couple of more things to hold, you walk up another mile, they're like, well, I'm halfway here. I'm not going to turn back now. And they'll follow you all the way up. So I think it's the same with world building. Don't try to give them everything at once. Trust that people will, if you're doing everything else right, people will stick with you for the rest of the ride.
And the characterization is so important. And and even without having finished necessary chaos, I can tell that characters are super important in this story. So you have to have that balance between the world, but, and this I think happens more frequently in science fiction, no shade to science fiction writers, but I think sometimes science fiction writers get enamored of the tech or get enamored of whatever the scenario is and forget the characters a little bit. And I'm sure some fantasy writers do this as well. What is your key to creating characters that pop?
For me, I think I definitely think about a few. Now, this, when creating characters, there's actually a few questions I definitely ask. Always think about what they want, what they're willing to do to get it, but also what they won't do to get it. Because I think most of us, we want things, but there are lines we won't cross to get it. And this one, once I came across this question and started asking it, it really made characters open up to me. What are they lying about? What are they lying about to themselves? What are they lying about to each other? Like, and also to how do they want to be perceived by others? How, like, because I think we all, like, we, especially when we interact with different people, we want to be perceived a certain way by those people. I don't think we all go through life thinking, I want everyone to perceive me the exact same way. So I think about those things. And then once I kind of figure that out, I figure out, okay, I'm looking at this spread of characters. Now, where do their interests clash? Where do they coincide? And how can I make that interesting?
That's great. I love it. Do you teach? It sounds like you teach.
No, I don't. I used to be a high school teacher for very briefly.
You can't, it bakes off you. You can't get away from the scent of a teacher. I can tell. Let's talk about FIA Literary Magazine for a while. You're their social media manager. It won a Hugo Award a couple years ago. Tell us, for people who don't know the magazine, a little bit about its mission and why are you excited to be a part of it?
So FIA is it was born out of spite, to be honest. So there was a report that came out, this was years ago, but it came out and it was a Black speculative fiction report. And it basically broke down the short fiction markets and how many Black writers they were publishing. And the numbers were abysmal. Like, it was like some places were like 1 or 2% of what they were publishing were Black writers. Some people just weren't publishing Black writers. And the responses to that report were very white, to be kind. They were, oh, well, we publish the best stories. We don't look at color.
See race.
Yeah. Or, we're not getting enough submissions from those people. Or, just a thousand excuses. And a group of us, we were all in a writer's Slack, and we were just seeing these responses, and it was just irritating us, like, to our cores. And so a group of us were like, you know what? Like, we can't wait around for these people to get their acts together. Let's do something ourselves. And so all of the founding members of the magazine, like, we were like, let's do it. Let's create our own magazine. And so, yeah, so we kind of kicked it off. We did our first issue. And it was funny, the first issue, a lot of people were kind of like writing us off. It's like, oh, this is a vanity project. Like, oh, this isn't going to go anywhere. And yeah, lo and behold, we're still here.
Yes, you are. And won a Hugo Award.
And won a Hugo.
Boom. Yeah. Yeah. Yay. Really just, and it is speculative fiction, correct? Yes. So it's just giving a platform for writers who've been formally excluded to have their stories told too. Yeah. Well, so you're out here now in San Diego. I'm assuming you're not writing full time, although if you are, God bless you, but that's a tough road. So you're balancing a day job or jobs, depending, with writing. How do you manage to do that and stay centered? This is something we ask all of our guests, because the Life Writing Podcast is all about that life art work balance. How have you found that balance, or are you still looking for it?
You know, I think I have found that balance, and I find it through, accepting that the only outcome I can control is the time I put into the writing, letting go of the other concerns, especially in terms of like publishing and like, will this get published? Will this get picked up? All that extra noise, like, you got to let it go because you can't control it. you just can't. It's just too many variables. And so I think that taking that extra noise out has just kind of allowed me to, when I sit down, I can just focus. I can focus and get the work done. And also too, though, like, hold on to your joy like fiercely, because this industry will rob you of it, and the world tries to rob you of it. Like it, the day job, like all the hassle of living in this very turbulent moment, it will try to rob you of your joy. So you gotta treat holding on to your joy as a task as serious as any other thing you do in your life. And because I think too often we dismiss joy as like frivolous, like, oh, that's just for fun. It's like, no, that's necessary. You got to hold on to it. And also too, I think what helps me kind of keep balance in my own writing and allows me to push forward with my writing is giving praise to others who are writing and reading their work.
Okay.
You know, because I think when you, Maya Angelou even talked about it, I think in the interview, it was like, I show up and give all I have, and every time I show up, and I think and giving to others and showing up for others is one of the best ways to keep yourself going. And I think that's a underestimated and undervalued thing sometimes. So
I completely agree with that. I try to practice that through social media in terms of boosting other writers, congratulating. My favorite thing to type is congratulations. And particularly in Hollywood, because, you know, Hollywood is going through a time of contraction. A lot of people are having trouble getting work, getting staffed, selling scripts. So when I see anybody who's actually managing to rise during this time, I want everybody to know about it, not just because it makes them feel good and I'm congratulating them on their accomplishments. But like you said, it's like it gives people hope. It's like, keep it up. If they did it, maybe you can do it too. And right. And that's just real, I think. And it makes me feel good and it inspires me to keep trying.
Right. Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, it's like in this world, there is so much shadow that's trying to cover everything. So it's like you got to fight the high point of light, like point that light and keep that light going. And like, you know, pushing back against all these negative forces out there that are, especially for writers. And I think like we wouldn't be doing this if we weren't inherently emotional beings. And I think, true, we observe and we observe well. And so I think observing in this moment is depressing. It is.
Oh my gosh. It's so is. Yeah.
And so you got to like find a way to observe and not let it make you shut down. And like, you know, be fierce about it. Be fierce about speaking up. And I think that is what keeps me going in terms of writing.
Are you very outspoken in social media in terms of current events?
I used to be, and I think I still am to some extent. I have like moments where it's like,
I know,
where it waves in and
things
out.
Have changed on Twitter, you know? It's not the same, really.
Yeah. Well, I also.
No, go on.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think too, I kind of like started understanding, like, you know, there's value in speaking up, but there's also value in doing the work. And I'm going to try to do the work and let the work do the speaking.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that, too. There are a lot of different ways to show up and there are a lot of different ways to speak up. And I think sometimes people get confused about that because social media is not the end all be all. And there are ways that it can be weaponized against you. So sometimes you have to sort of weigh, where am I most valuable? Where is my voice most valuable? Where's my impact most valuable? Right. So that is all fantastic. Well, how can people find you if they want to reach out to you on social media?
Yeah, sure. I try to keep all my usernames the same. So I'm Brent C. Lambert on Twitter. It's Brent C. Lambert on Blue Sky. And my Instagram is Brent C. Lambert Writes. And my website, also the same, BrentCLambert.com. So,
bless you. I do not understand. And I'm apologies in advance to anyone in the audience this applies to. But people who have these usernames that are no way related to their actual name, but they're using it for business.
Yeah.
I don't, because you know how you're trying to compose a tweet and you want to tag somebody, especially Instagram. It's like, oh, I got to do a Google search to figure out what your Instagram handle is.
Yes.
And now I've spent 15 minutes working on this when I just wanted to say congratulations.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, I have really enjoyed talking to you. I know, in fact, that you've given our listeners, a lot to think about in terms of world building and character and staying in the game. What's up next for you?
So actually, I have a couple of things coming up. So I have turned in a story for this. It's a queer anthology that's kind of like looking at pulp science fiction and fantasy through a queer lens. It's a really great title. It's hilarious. It's called I Want That Twink Obliterated. It is.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Okay. But I have something with that, so I'm just waiting back for edits. I'm also working on a sword and sorcery story for an anthology that's upcoming. And I am also currently working on a novel. It's not contracted yet, but, you know, I'm hoping it's the one that got me an agent. So, yeah, so I got to get that solidified and kind of good to go. It's, I guess, a quick pitch for it. It's kind of like black ballroom fantasy. And yeah, and like, but merged with the X-Men, too. So it's so it's kind of interesting.
I love your genre bending. Well, I'm so glad we could have you on the podcast, Brent. It's great to catch you at the beginning of your career and hear your thoughts that helped you get here. Don't forget to check out our Life Writing Premium course, which is weekly digital downloads that Steve and I provide with lectures, essays that we've done at colleges, we've done in other parts of the world, to help you stay on your writing journey. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you much, Brent. Everybody have a great day. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.